Hey, y'all, welcome back to Erase the State. Maddie K here with a special guest, the one and only Mr. Mike Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center. Mike, how are you?
I'm doing good, Matt. You know, how could you turn down a podcast called Erase the State? That may be the best podcast name out there. I love it.
Well, thank you very much. In that vein, I couldn't think of a better guest to have on the show than you and somebody from the 10th Amendment Center to talk about the things that you do. So let's go ahead and jump right into that. For the folks that don't know what you do, which I'd be surprised if any of our listeners don't know, but please give us a brief introduction about yourself and the 10th Amendment Center, please.
All right. Well, I am the National Communications Director for the spine organization known as the 10th Amendment Center. And in a nutshell, the 10th Amendment Center is an organization that is focused on decentralization, primarily utilizing the U.S. Constitution and the original intent, which was actually to have a decentralized system with most of the power remaining to the states and the people themselves. I always tell people up front with an audience that is going to be largely anti-state that it's not that we believe state governments are inherently better than the federal government. It's really a matter of decentralization. Multiple jurisdictions competing for power and resources is better than one centralized authority lording over everybody. And in my never-to-be-humble opinion, a monopoly government is the biggest threat to freedom that we face. And it's interesting because, you know, most people intuitively understand that monopoly in the economic realm is probably not going to be a good thing. I mean, we could debate whether an actual monopoly is even possible or not if you want to talk economics. But I think theoretically, you know, if somebody said, okay, Walmart is going to be the only provider of groceries in the United States, most people would say, maybe not such a good idea. You know, sure. You'd expect higher prices. You'd expect worse service. You would expect, the people there to have less concern about what its customers' needs are. Well, it's no different with government. And it always blows my mind, particularly with people on the left who are so intuitively opposed to monopoly in the economic realm. All of a sudden, when it comes to government, they want monopoly. Well, no, it's just as bad for all the same reasons. So that's philosophically where we're coming from the 10th Amendment Center. We kind of do our work along two streams, if you will. One is education, talking about the original Constitution, what it means. And it's amazing for something that's supposed to be a founding document, and people call it the law of the land.
Right.
How few people really understand what it says, what it means, what it was intended to do. There's all kinds of misunderstandings about the Constitution out there. Number one, that it somehow was meant to protect our liberty. It was not meant to do any such thing. It was meant to establish a government. So, you know, government and liberty are and antithetical to each other. But what the Constitution did do was it created intended to create a centralized government with relatively limited power and authority over a small realm of things. So we educate people about that. You know, in some ways, it's kind of thumb your nose at the people on the right who profess to be lovers of the Constitution and then ignore it just as much as the people on the left. It actually was founded in 2006. Everybody thinks 10th Amendment Center, it has to be a right-wing thing. And it was actually founded by Michael Bolton, kind of in reaction to the overreaches that happened in the wake of 9/11 by the Bush administration, Patriot Act and those types of things. So the other side of the coin, we do state legislative work, which is really the nuts and bolts of our work, activism. And we use state and local power and encourage individuals as well to basically ignore the feds.
I like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And in so doing, it neuters their ability to enforce their laws and implement their programs. The best example in modern times, I think, obviously, is the marijuana prohibition. You know, today, the federal government still claims complete marijuana prohibition. And yet we have 10 states that have completely legalized marijuana. We have 33 states that have legalized it for medical use. The federal government can't enforce prohibition without state and local cooperation. We would like to see people utilize this same strategy on a whole range of issues. I mean, you could shut down federal gun control if states would simply quit enforcing it. You could shut down Obamacare if states would simply quit implementing it. So that's the kind of work that we do on a nuts and bolts level. It's a decentralizing work. It encourages people to resist in a way that is not violent. You know, we're not trying to spur a revolution. We're trying to use smaller power units to undermine the larger power unit and therefore decentralize the system. So that's kind of the nutshell version of what we do. I'm sure we could go into other details however you want to go with it.
Well, since you brought up the cannabis issue, do you see that as a way to get people sort of rallied behind your cause, since that's kind of a hot topic right now for a lot of people? Is that the aha way in to get people's hearts and minds won over?
It depends on who you're talking to. So we always joke that the 10th Amendment Center is about guns and weed. You know, so
typical libertarianism, right?
Yeah, exactly. But you know, your folks that tend to lean to the right, especially, you know, I've been with the organization for 10 years now. So, you know, you go back 8 or 9 years and it was hard to talk to people on the right about marijuana.
Sure.
It's amazing how much the public perception has changed, even over the last 4 or 5 years. And that didn't stop me from talking about weed. In fact, I used to get it, you know, back when the Tea Party was a thing, I spoke a lot at Tea Party groups because they were supposed to be constitutionalist, which after the election of Trump, we found out that was absolutely false. But
nominally constitutionalist.
Yeah, exactly. But I would talk to a lot of Tea Party groups and I would always bring up weed, you know, as an example and tell people, you know, whether or not you like marijuana or whether you think marijuana should be thing, it's not anything that the federal government should be involved in.
Sure.
And you could usually get people on board with that. It certainly was, especially back in the Obama years, it was a really good way to kind of smooth things over with people on the left. You know, there's this knee-jerk reaction that if you're talking about quote-unquote states' rights, and I hate that term, but that's the term that people use. But, you know, he had to be a racist, you know, and you're for slavery, you know, as if anybody in 2019 is for slavery. But, you know, that was the impression. And so you could kind of wiggle your way in by and it would really blow people in the mainstream media away because they had a preconceived notion that basically you were most of the time they figured that you were trying to stop gay marriage. That was usually
sure.
So, you know, you'd start talking about weed and it would totally throw these reporters off. Today, I like to use when I'm talking to the left, if I'm getting any pushback, I like to talk about immigration because the immigration sanctuary cities are a fantastic example of how state and local action can thwart thwart the feds. The right doesn't hate sanctuary cities because they don't work. They
right.
hate them because they do work. And, you know, it's another prime example of the federal government needing state and local support to do what it wants to do. So, you know, it really just depends on your audience and who you're talking to, kind of the issues that we bring up. In terms of our actual work, we love doing cross-party, bipartisan coalition building. It's especially effective in areas like surveillance where you can get a broad base support from both people on the left and right. So we do a lot of that type of work where, you know, we'll be working with folks at the ACLU and at the same time, conservative organizations that are concerned about privacy. So from that perspective, we really, from a practical standpoint, we love building single issue coalitions. And then you can kind of sneak in the principles with those folks as you're getting to know
sure.
them and working with them.
Since you brought up sanctuary cities, I'd love to talk about immigration, but I saw a couple of tweets.
Half the people will turn off your show.
Well, I don't know. Maybe not my listeners.
Depending on what side of the equation you fall.
Exactly. Well, I saw a couple of tweets about the 10th Amendment Center. I'm not sure who runs your Twitter account, but I believe it was in response to a report that came out here locally to me. I'm in Fort Bend County, Texas, but very nearby okay. is Montgomery County, Texas. Who
yeah.
I believe has just sort of passed some sort of, you can explain it better, but it's a sanctuary county initiative, I guess, for guns.
Yeah,
can you
exactly.
explain more about that and how we should see what happened?
So there's good news and bad news in all of this. We're seeing a big movement in counties across the country. There's a number in Texas. There are a bunch in Oregon. I think Illinois had a few. So a number of different states where we got these county commissions, or sometimes it's sheriff's departments, but they're creating what they're calling gun sanctuary cities. Mm-hmm. And they're doing the right thing in terms of the principle. They're recognizing that immigration has been thwarted. Immigration enforcement has been thwarted by cities like San Francisco and you know many other cities that have declared themselves sanctuaries. And what these cities are actually doing is they are simply not involving themselves in the enforcement of certain immigration laws. They're not really blocking federal enforcement. You know, they're not kicking ICE agents out of the county or anything like that. But what they're doing is they're not playing. They're sure. not involving themselves. They're not giving information to the feds. They're basically keeping it kind of hands off. And this is really a difficult problem because there's only a few ICE agents, relatively speaking. They can't handle the entire workload. They're depending on the cooperation of state and local governments. Well, it's the same thing like I mentioned earlier with gun control. You know, without state and local police enforcing gun control, it's not going to get enforced. It's just like marijuana. You know, if you've ever watched on TV, you'll see these federal drug raids, and you'll see like two dudes in DEA jackets and then mm-hmm. 45 local cops and about 30 sheriff's deputies, you know. Well, take away the local cops and the sheriff deputies, you're left with three DEA agents. They're not going to do a whole lot. So right. A lot of these folks have recognized, and we've been pushing this, gun people, get some gonads, be like the weed people, and actually do something to resist instead of, you know, trying to create a lawsuit in it, the Supreme Court that you're going to lose. And so they've kind of started to do this. And the whole idea is we're not going to enforce federal gun laws in our county. It's a great concept. The problem that we're trying to point out, and people get mad at us when we point this out because, you know, nobody wants bad news. But the problem is they're approaching this by passing resolutions instead of passing actual county ordinances.
Sure.
And there's a big difference. A resolution in most states is non-binding. It's a statement of opinion. So, you know, they're saying, well, it's our opinion that we're not going to enforce gun laws in this county. But it's not binding on anybody. You can't enforce it. It's not a law. So they need to be passing actual ordinances that prohibit the use of personnel and resources in the county to enforce federal gun laws. If you put it in ordinance form where it's actually binding on all of the employees of the county or the city, as the case may be, then you have something with some actual teeth. What you're getting right now is these resolutions that really don't do anything in a practical sense, won't hold up in any kind of legal way. And so they're basically standing on a pile of sand, and it's going to fall down if anybody challenges it. It's not going to have any practical effect. So, And it's cool if you want to pass the resolution as a first step. That can be a good political, a good political strategy. We've seen people pass a resolution. It creates some momentum. It creates some excitement. It creates public support. And then you take a further step and you actually do a binding law. But you can't just do the resolution and then go home and think you've actually accomplished something. So that's kind of the issue that we're dealing with there.
So is that something that your organization is chasing sort of on the ground? Do you have people committed to helping get ordinances passed or just, I hate to say it, but additional laws passed that could promote liberty? Or are you just doing like you're doing right now and coming on podcasts, getting on whatever show you can to spread the message?
A little bit of both. As much as we can with the resources that we have, we definitely interface and interact with people on the ground at the local level. And a lot of our, you know, we're really a pretty small organization.
Sure.
In terms of our manpower. It's basically just two of us in terms of quote unquote staff. And then we've got a number of volunteers. So we're really depending on coalition building and networking and outreaching. So, you know, we definitely are reaching out to folks and trying to get the message out and trying to get people to take good practical steps and use good legislation. It's just, you know, it's hard. This whole thing has kind of snowballed in the last few months. And so we're trying to get a handle on it and get people pointed in the right direction.
Sure. So I know when I've heard Michael Bolden on other people's shows, he's mentioned a lot of the efforts that you guys have gone through about, say, turning off the water to NSA centers and things like that. Is that still an ongoing effort? Can you give us an update on how that sort of thing is progressing?
Yeah, that was one. That's the coolest thing that we've ever done. And for people who don't know, basically what we discovered was that the NSA, and this all kind of came to fruition at the point that Snowden was bringing out a lot of his revelations about what the NSA was doing. We started thinking, you know, what could we do at the state and local level? We don't do anything in Washington, D.C. In fact, sometimes we joke, you should never call the 202 area code. You know, it just it's pointless. Congress isn't going to get anything done.
Or pick we'd up much the rather. Phone.
Yeah, right. Well, they'll pick up the phone and then you'll get an email that's unrelated to your phone call. You know, right. you talk to some pimply intern somewhere, but you can't actually have a practical effect at the state and local level. Those folks are not used to political pressure. They're not used to getting phone calls from constituents. So you have a little bit more leverage. But so anyway, we came up with this idea based on the fact that the NSA had maxed out the power grid in Maryland. And so they were actually looking for places with better electrical grid where they could build new facilities because, you know, they're trying to store everybody's information. That's a lot of information to store. And so they built this facility in Bluffdale, Utah. And as it turns out, the facility uses like, I don't remember what the exact number is anymore. I think it's like 64,000 gallons of water or 64 million. Some it's absurd amount of water that the facility uses every day to cool all these supercomputers that are storing, you know, all of your phone calls, emails, web browsing history, all those types of things.
Sure.
And that water is actually supplied through a contract from a city water department. There is no obligation for the city or the state to supply water to the NSA. You know, it's based on a contract. So in a very real sense, the state of Utah could turn off the water to that NSA facility. And we actually had quite a bit of momentum going with it a few years ago. Unfortunately, commander of the National Guard there put the clamps on some committee members and got the bill buried in the Rules Committee. Basically told them this is not going to see the light of day. And I'm really curious because I never could really get the whole story from the bill sponsor. It would be interesting to know what was actually said behind the scenes. I think they put the screws on him pretty hard. But anyway, so we've seen some bills introduced over the last few years in other states that have facilities. It's definitely something we would still like to happen, but right now there doesn't seem to be the legislative will to do such a thing. But we're continuing to push on the surveillance issue primarily through state and local efforts to create warrant requirements on a lot of this surveillance technology that police departments are using now, basically without any oversight or restriction at all. Things like Stingray devices that can pick up cell phone calls. Facial recognition is big right now. Drone surveillance and these type of things. So by creating warrant requirements at the state level, it basically limits the amount of information that state and local police can gather. And what we've learned is that basically the scenario is kind of the feds fund these state and local police, give them grants and you know, sometimes outright give them equipment in order to facilitate surveillance. And then they tap into the information that's gathered through these networks that are called fusion centers and information sharing environments. So what we've really focused on the last couple of years is just limiting the amount of information that can be gathered and kind of backdoor creating impediments for the federal surveillance state. But along this line, something that's really cool, and I haven't really talked about this a lot. You're kind of, I'm breaking the news here.
I like it.
There's a legislator in West Virginia named Pat McGeehan, and Pat's one of the about three politicians that I actually like and trust. he has introduced, like since 2015, a bill in the West Virginia legislature that would prohibit the deployment of the West Virginia National Guard unless there's an actual declaration of war. And of course, you know, the Pentagon depends on National Guard units to fill a lot of these combat regiments in Absolutely. Afghanistan and Iraq and all of these places where all of these illegal wars are going on. And last year, he actually managed to do some parliamentary maneuvers and get it on the House floor. And so there's a little bit of momentum behind this. And so he's working really hard, hoping to get, and it's looking like he's well on the way of getting about 20 states to introduce similar bills in this next legislative session, which will start in 2020. So this could be just a really, you know, kind of a turn off the water kind of thing, but, you know, turn off the National Guard troops and at least force Congress to declare war before they send U.S. troops bumbling into every desert in, you know, the entire world. So pretty excited about that for this year. I know for a fact of five states that are going to introduce this. And like I said, he's working towards at least 20. So something that could kind of make a national splash. And if, you know, if it gains some momentum, it might be a way to, you know, at least put the screws on the warfare state. And I really think there's going to be a lot of public support for this, because I think people are tired of the wars. I think there's a pretty strong consensus that, you know, maybe it's not such a good idea to be fighting in Afghanistan for what now, how many years are we? 20?
Too long. It's, nearly 20. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's absolutely absurd. So that's a pretty cool thing that we've got going. And this is the kind of thing that we try to do at the 10th Amendment Center, creative ways to undermine federal power, utilizing the power of our state and local government. Since we have those tools there, might as well use them.
Do you see any direct pushback from the feds? I know, just as an example, right? I mean, Louisiana was like one of the last states that allowed cockfighting and 18-year-old drinking, right? And that all came to a crashing halt when the federal government decided to withhold, I think it was highway funds. So yeah, that was going to collapse the already terrible road system in Louisiana. So they capitulated and changed their laws. So do you see that happening around certain states? Do you get any personal pushback at the organization from the feds?
The only real pushback that we've gotten personally is we have gotten a letter from the Department of Defense complaining about us reporting on the militarization of police. They took issue with the fact that we were calling MRAPs, you know, the armored personnel carriers. Sure. We were calling those tanks, which ironically most of the soldiers in the field call them tanks too. You know, they didn't think we should be calling them tanks. So yeah, I do have a letter from the DOD, which was kind of cool. But I, you know, honestly, a lot of the pushback that states get, truthfully, it's more a matter of their lack of willingness to stand up and have some balls than it is actual things that the feds can do. And this is one area where the federal courts have actually done liberty a favor. There's a well-established legal doctrine called the anti-commandeering doctrine. And I won't get into a lot of legal mumbo jumbo, but the long and short of it is that the federal courts have held since about 1842 that the federal government cannot force states to utilize their own personnel or resources, i.e. money, in order to enforce federal laws or implement federal programs. They can do it if they want to, but they can't be forced to do it. So anti-commandeering. So when the feds try to say, well, we're going to make the states do it, they can't make it. It's actually the Constitution and the legal environment is such that when states refuse to enforce gun laws or refuse to enforce marijuana laws or refuse to enforce federal gambling laws or whatever it may be, they're on solid legal ground. And they're even limited to what they can do in terms of withholding funds. And this is the thing that a lot of people don't know. They can only withhold funds that directly connect with the thing that the state is not doing. Hmm. So for instance, in terms of immigration, this is the reason that Trump hasn't really been able to make any headway against sanctuary cities, because you can only withhold funds that directly relate to the enforcement of immigration law. And that's not a whole lot of funds.
Sure.
And in terms of the amount of funding, it can't be coercive. Now, that's a moving target. What's coercive mean? That's, you know, in the eyes of the court. But still, there's some limit to what the feds can do. So in other words, with the drunk driving laws, federal government did use federal highway funds to basically coerce states into adopting the 21-year-old drinking age. But it was actually a rather small amount of federal highway funds in the big scheme of things. And the courts ruled that it was not to the point of being coercive. They weren't threatening to withhold enough funds. You know, they weren't withholding all federal highway funds. It was sure, a small portion. And they were saying this small portion is not enough to be considered coercive. Basically, the reasoning being is that the state could forego those funds and still be able to function basically in the same way that they have. So the fact that these states have capitulated on these things has more to do with the fact that they don't want to lose even this little bit of funding, more than it does that the feds have, you know, this draconian ability to take away funding or force the state's hand. It's really a matter of getting the states to recognize the fact that foregoing these funds would actually give them more power, and say so over policy in their own state. And it was interesting because a couple of years ago, there was a pretty big movement of counties rejecting HUD funds because the federal government put a whole bunch of new stipulations on these funds, and particularly in terms of having to basically force integration and whatnot. And a lot of the counties just said, you know what? This is ridiculous. I mean, yeah, this is nice money, but it's not worth it with all the stuff that we have to do to meet the criteria. So they started saying F you, HUD, and yeah. and rejecting funds. So, you know, when the will is there, they can do it. Unfortunately, you know, dollars tend to rule the roost when it comes to government. So you have to have a lot of public pressure and a lot of public vigilance in order to really move these things forward. And even with something like surveillance, where there's a lot of, you know, most people don't really want to be spied on, but police lobbies are so strong. You really have to have a strong coalition on the other side of the fence, pushing lawmakers to pass laws that would limit surveillance. So, you know, this is why I tell people, if I know some people that are libertarian, particularly ANCAPs, anarchists, you know, they don't want to get involved in the political sphere whatsoever. And I certainly respect that. But I know a lot of people do want to get involved in the political sphere. I always urge them, do it at your local level. Do it at your state level. Don't get in presidential politics or worrying about who the congressman is going to be or, you know, all of that stuff, because it's not going to fundamentally change anything. You can fundamentally change things at your local level. You can create a coalition of people and force your city council to put restrictions on surveillance. Much easier than you're going to get the Congress to, you know, get rid of the Patriot Act.
Sure, sure. Well, this anarchist just joined the LP to try and get Hornberger elected. So,
well, there you go.
I'll try it with locally as well.
Well, and you know, between you and me, I you know, I'm not going to join the LP, but that's a whole nother story. But I like Hornberger, and I would support him in a presidential run, because I think that he would do a fantastic job articulating libertarian principles. I don't think he's ever going to become president.
Sure.
You know? I mean, let's be real. But I think he has the potential of having the national stage. And I'm confident that he can articulate libertarian principles to the broader audience and bring issues of anti-war and in the Fed and the things that he's so good at. But I don't see it as a way of actually changing the political system. I see it as a way of changing hearts and minds at that level. So that's my caveat on. But if you really think you're going to get somebody elected president and change Washington, D.C., you're insane. And the Hope and Change Democrats learned that when Obama was elected. We basically got Bush policy wrapped up in Obama style. And if people were honest, what we have now is Obama policy wrapped up in Trump style. I mean, policies haven't changed all that much.
It's just federal government policy. It doesn't matter who the president is.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and the bottom line is the federal government's going to keep on spying on you, and it's going to keep on engaging in unconstitutional wars, and it's going to keep running trillion-dollar deficits, and you're going to get bipartisan agreement whenever there's an opportunity to screw the individual. So,
sure.
This is the analogy that I use. You know, the federal system is broken. The whole system is upside down from what it should be. You know, it should be local governments are the most powerful, state governments after that, federal government, you barely should even notice it exists. Of course, in the world we live in today, the federal government basically is the overlord of all, and your states have been relegated to counties and localities don't matter whatsoever. And to fix that by electing a new president is just insane. It's just as insane as having a car on blocks and thinking, I'm going to get a new driver and fix the car.
You know, sure.
Driver's not going to fix it. The car is still on blocks. So, you know, that's why we, again, you know, this can be the emphasis of the show, bottom-up approach. You know, local and state politics is where you can have some practical impact if that's the way that you choose to go about your work.
So since you mentioned cops earlier, what sort of work is the 10th Amendment Center doing around the militarization of police and sort of police violence and overreach and that sort of thing?
Yeah, the biggest thing that we've done in terms of police is, well, I think there's two things. The most direct thing is really trying to stop this militarization of police. And this happens primarily through a program called 1033, which is a Department of Defense program that puts military surplus gear into the hands of police departments. They can basically just apply for it. They have to maintain it, but they can get it. And this is anything from, you know, camouflage uniforms to assault rifles. I hate the term assault rifle, but that's what it calls them. You know, bayonets, the MRAPs, all types of military equipment, surveillance gear. It comes through this 1033 program. And then it also, there's also a lot of money that flows through federal grant programs, also through the Department of Defense. And so with these, with this money and with these grant programs, police departments have loaded up on this military gear. And it's amazing. I did a report for a newspaper that I freelance for here in Kentucky, and went through every county and looked at the military equipment that they had procured. And Kentucky has 120 counties. And I think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of in the 90s that had received some type of gear. And, you know, almost every police department in the state has gotten AR-15s or M16s or some type of, you know, semi-automatic military style rifle through the 1033 program. And then that, you know, not to mention surveillance equipment and all of the other goodies that come with it. So, you know, that's one state. And the thing that's so nefarious about this is that, you know, if you take a cop and you put them in fatigues and you give them a military style weapon and you give them an army helmet and you put them in a tank, they start to think they're soldiers. And that's exactly the way they're interacting with the public. This, I say they've turned protect and serve into command and control. It's completely changed the mentality of policing. And so we support legislation that does one of two things. Number one, best case scenario, ban the acquisition of some of this military equipment completely. The kind of first step, if they're not willing to go that far, is at least require city government approval after a public, after some type of public meeting, so that people can have the ability to chime in and stop this stuff, you know, to at least create oversight and transparency to the system. So that's the first step. The bigger step is in the drug war, because most of the aggressive policing is driven by the drug war. And like I said, you've got command and control, you've got the militarization aspect of it, and they have to do it because they're fighting a war.
Sure.
You know? So, you know, by legalizing marijuana, and, you know, we're starting to see some movement in some states to legalize. I can't say the word properly, so I'm not going to try it. We'll just say magic mushrooms.
Psilocybin.
That stuff. You know, we're starting to see that is kind of the next front on that. And by attacking the drug war, which incidentally, in case anybody was wondering, the federal government has absolutely no authority to prohibit marijuana or any other substance. And people who doubt this from a constitutional standpoint just need to ask themselves why it required a constitutional amendment to prohibit alcohol. And what's changed in the ensuing 75 years? Well, absolutely nothing, other than the fact that the Congress has gotten more and more comfortable simply ignoring its restriction on its power. So as far as policing goes, directly ending the acquisition of these military gear, and then broader picture, stop the damn drug war.
I hear you. So this is all I have for the 10th Amendment, Senator, but I might ask you to change hats a little bit if you don't mind putting on the Godarchy hat for a while.
Yeah, I'd love to.
So did we miss anything from the 10th Amendment, Senator, standpoint?
No, I'll just say, if you're interested in what we're doing, please visit 10thAmendmentCenter.com. I would argue, and yes, I'm biased, but I would argue that there is no libertarian organization doing more on the ground from a political standpoint than the work that we're doing. We're engaged with state legislators, especially when you get into sessions, which usually run, you know, from January through April, May. Every day we're working with state legislators. We're getting stuff passed. Over the last couple of years, in the last three or four legislative sessions, we've seen as many as 500 bills introduced across the country that undermine federal power in some way. So we're doing some powerful work. And if you're interested in seeing what we're doing, go to 10thAmendmentCenter.com. It's all spelled out. And if you're interested in getting involved, we're always looking for folks who are willing to kind of be boots on the ground in your own community, you know, pester your own state legislators, do some kind of lobbying kind of stuff. If you're a writer, we're always looking for people who can write blog posts and stuff on the website. And if you're interested in joining the 10th Amendment Center and supporting us financially, you can do that for as little as $2 a month. And there's some benefits and access that members get that the rest of the world doesn't. So check out what we're doing, because, you know, I've been doing this for 10 years. And, you know, I actually came into the 10th Amendment Center as a neocon. So I tell people that the 10th Amendment is a gateway drug to libertarianism. Or, you know, even the gateway drug to anarchy, if you dig into it deep enough. So, yeah, I think it's important, good, solid work, and we covet everybody's support.
Well, as Sherry Voluntary would say, every good libertarian is actually an anarchist, so.
Yes, indeed.
All right, so, Godarchy hat on, right?
Yes.
Mike, how can you be such a libertarian and anarchist and hate the state so much when Romans 13 exists?
Oh, yes. Well, if you're really interested, there's an entire podcast that I've dedicated to that very subject at godarchy.org. It's like the fifth or sixth episode that I did. Do you really want me to answer that question?
Please. Yeah, go ahead. I listened to that episode twice, but yes, I always like to hear it, and I'd like to have it on my show for posterity. So
the short answer is, I think people misunderstand what it means to submit. I don't think submit necessarily means obey. And the kind of example that I use is Rosa Parks. I love Rosa Parks. She's one of my personal heroes, just because, and I know somebody out there, well, she was a cunt. Shut up. I know. But what she did, and the personal fortitude and the risk and the cost that she was willing to undertake to do what she thought was right, I think is inspiring. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, she exemplifies to me kind of the Romans 13 ethos. She refused to submit to an unjust law. When they told her to get up out of the seat in the bus and move back a few rows, she said she wasn't going to do it. But she didn't tear up the bus. She didn't try to beat up the bus driver. You know, she didn't try to shoot the cop when he got on the bus. She let him arrest her. She paid her fine. She spent a couple of days in jail. She did not obey an unjust law, but she did submit. And I think that's kind of what, in my view, what Romans 13 is getting at. It certainly doesn't mean you support and obey everything that the government does. It's absurd. Common sense tells you that that's not true. There are countless examples throughout the Bible, from the Old Testament to the New Testament, where godly people disobeyed government edicts, you know, and we could make a huge long list of them. We could start with Peter, who was told to quit preaching and said, sorry, got to obey the laws of God, not the laws of man. So clearly it doesn't mean what some of your, you know, hardcore right winger statist will tell you that it means. Well, you must do everything that the government does and you must obey it and like it. Well, okay. Yeah. So the Nazi guard was obeying the laws of God? I don't think so. So that's kind of the short version. I think there's some theological nuance that you could get into, but you know, to me, it has to do with the way you approach your resistance to the state. I don't believe in violent revolution, because I don't think using violence is going to get you a free society, because you're basically building your society on the very thing that the state is built on, which is coercion, force, and violence. Sure. And so, you know, I know a lot of people debate me on that. I'm really close to being a pacifist. so, but you know, I think that comes down to kind of a personal decision that people of faith have to make on their own. And I'm certainly not going to tell somebody who's not a believer that, you know, you shouldn't use defensive violence, because that's not my place. But
sure.
Anyway.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you for coming on the show. Please plug everything again.
All right. So 10thAmendmentCenter.com. That's the first place I want you to go and support the work that we're doing, or at least check out the work that we're doing. I think You know, I think it's interesting, even for those of you anarchists who want to quote Spooner at me and tell me that the Constitution is of no authority. Yeah, I get all that. But the fact of the matter is, it is the law of the man. I'll tell you a funny story. I have to give you this anecdote because I haven't told anybody this other than a few people personally. But I've been dying to tell somebody this, like in a public setting. I was going through one of the threads. I might have been on the Mises Caucus. Mm-hmm. Libertarian call. I don't remember where it was. It was on Facebook thread though. And it was actually about Hornberger. And somebody was like, well, he's too much into the Constitution. I'm not into the Constitution. That's a statist document. I'm not going to support a presidential candidate that's for the Constitution. I'm like, you utter idiot. The presidency is a office that is created by the statist constitution that you don't. So why are you, I mean, I get it, but if you're not going to, if you're going to involve yourself in American politics, you should follow the rules that American politics are supposed to follow. You can't just throw out the whole constitution and say, well, it's a statist document because the whole system is statist.
Sure. Sure.
So, so I had to share that, but anyway, I don't even know what sparked that. Go visit the 10thAmendmentCenter.com. You can learn about the Constitution if you want to be involved in U.S. politics, and you can find out how off track that we really are, what the Constitution really is supposed to mean, and what kind of power that gives us in terms of promoting and moving liberty at least a few steps forward. You can go to my own personal website. I have a podcast that I've been really remiss in keeping up with called Thoughts from a Hairy Head, which is primarily about decentralization and constitutional issue. Kind of goes along with my 10th Amendment Center work. There's a couple of books that I've written that you can find on that website that involve those subjects. And if you want to dispense with all the statusness and just go pure anarchy, you can go to godarchy.org, which is primarily focused toward a Christian audience. But I think it's packaged in such a way that even if you're not a believer, as long as you're not like a militant atheist, you're probably going to get some value out of what we're doing over there. Because I talk a lot about the philosophies of liberty and the, you know, the ideas of non-aggression and personal ownership, self-ownership, and those types of things, which I think we can broadly agree on as libertarians, whether or not we're coming at it from a theological or a more secular perspective. So, and I like to bang on the, you know, one of the things that there's two things that I really hit on theme-wise over at Godarchy a lot. One of those is anti-war. I wanted to be an anti-war voice within the realm of Christianity, because I think, especially in the United States, the church is far too quick to beat the drums of war. And then the other thing that I like to do is just hold up a mirror to people and make them own their own violence. You know, the sanctimonious lefties who, well, you don't want to help the poor and I'm better than you because I care about people. And you know what I mean? You don't care about people when you're pointing guns at their head. So I do a lot of that, hold up the mirror to the statist and try to make them at least own their own violence. So you can check that out at godarchy.org. And if you're interested in economics and particularly Federal Reserve stuff and precious metals, I do actually maintain the website over at shiftgold.com. And I have a podcast that I do every Friday called the Friday Gold Wrap, which typically involves precious metals news with a real strong focus on what the Fed's doing and monetary policy and government spending and all that kind of stuff. So if you like Peter Schiff, the Schiff Gold website is a good addition to the work that he's doing. So I think that's all the stuff.
There you go. Well, we'll make sure and put all that in the show notes for everybody to check out. Mike, thanks again. You're welcome anytime. Loved having you on. Folks, you know what to do. Like, subscribe, rate, review, tell a friend, tell your mom, tell your dad. Peace. Cross a 57 Chevy with a hillbilly band. Had a little honky tonk filled with one night stands. Take a tell him fire with a gonzo steel. In a dark house space just to seal the deal. Top 40 country, better watch your back, 'cause this hot rod's faster than your Cadillac.